Hi, I'm Shireen Gourbani, and you are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle.
The unsupervised edition.
That's right. So I'm on the political left. I have with me John Dougal on the right.
State auditor. And Natalie's not with us today.
Yeah, I feel badly because I'm certain she told us, but I can't remember where she is. But I hope that she's having a great week. I'm certain she's just quite busy.
I'm sure it's a very important meeting.
Yeah, you know it. But we decided that we would take this a little differently today. So the idea that we're going to start with is really talking. I wanted to ask John just a little bit more. I would love to ask you a little bit more about the auditor's office. So when we see every now and then, you know, I'm a close news follower and reader, and we see, okay, the auditor. State auditor says
breaking
this, did
news.
That, releases a report. I'm wondering if you can talk about just some of the structural things, like what is it that you are tasked to oversee? What are some of the things that you're seeing now, or are there some trends? How long have you been in the role?
Uh-huh.
And I'd love to hear you talk about some trends, and then also I'd love to get into a little bit more when it comes to, I think, just the overall role in terms of accountability, transparency, and some of those bigger themes.
Okay. Great questions. And you'll have to prompt me as we go along.
No problem.
As I go down the checklist. But the very first thing is usually when you hear state auditor in the news, that might be my office or that might be the legislative auditor general. We're both auditors. My title is state auditor. I'm elected every 4 years statewide, just like, you know, the governor and attorney general and the treasurer. The legislative auditor general is the auditor for the legislature. So he is tasked by the legislature to look at issues that they're concerned with.
So his
focus is what we call performance and compliance audits.
So how would something end up in his office versus yours?
So in his office, that would be legislators make requests of the Legislative Audit Committee, and that Legislative Audit Committee tasks the Legislative Auditor General. And so it's issues specifically that legislators care about. For my office, and I describe them as kind of like the special forces. The legislature senses a concern and parachutes them in to go look at an issue. I'm more like the general infantry. There's a whole bunch of things in statute that are my responsibilities. We do the financial statement audits for the state and public colleges and universities. And so right now is our busy season. The state fiscal year ended June 30th. So we are auditing the state's financial statements, and we cross our fingers, hope to be done with that on Friday. But this is a very, very busy time for us. We also do what's called the single audit, but this is the federal funds compliance audit. And the state, depending on the year, gets anywhere from about 20 to 30% of its money that it spends from the federal government. So it's taxes we pay to the federal government that then come back for various federal programs. And so we go in and check compliance, making sure folks are complying with all the regulations when it comes with those federal programs and those dollars.
So people might not know, but they also have county auditors. So we have every county has an auditor. Sometimes that's a role that's got some dual responsibilities in our smaller counties. What's your relationship to county auditors?
Let me get there in just a minute.
Sounds great.
Let me keep going through my office.
Oh, I know. Titillating radio.
That's right.
But it really
financial
is important
statement
to understand.
And this helps people understand what's
right.
going on with their money. And financial statement audits are helping say whether those financial statements, whether the public, bondholders, others can rely on the representations. And that's the opinion that we issue, whether or not they fairly represent the financial position. We also oversee local government. So we're a regulator of cities and counties and school districts and special local districts. There are almost 1,000 governmental entities.
Yeah, I was going to pause you there. Can you give an example of a special local district or two?
Yeah, UTA is a district, a big one. There's little cemetery districts, water districts, irrigation districts, on and on and on.
Yeah.
So you think 248 cities and towns, 29 counties, 41 school districts, 100 or so charter schools, and then 400 plus special local districts and interlocal agencies. Down where I live, the Alpine Highland Police is really an interlocal agency between Alpine City and Highland City that formed a police and fire agency.
Okay, and just to reiterate, what's your responsibility in those agencies?
So we're making sure they properly adopt their budgets.
Yeah.
They submit their end-of-year financial reports. For those, most of those or many of those are audited. We train the CPA firms and set the expectation of what the CPA firm should be looking at that. And I tell folks, it's important that they tell the public how they intend to spend their money. And then it's important that they timely report on how they actually did.
Yeah.
You know, the plan versus actual can be different.
Sure.
But it's important to let the public know. And we actually have a hammer there. If an entity is non-compliant, we start withholding their tax money.
Right.
It's a strong incentive for them to get their reports in and report to the public.
And how many times have you had to do that? Like, how many times did you do that last year?
I don't recall exactly off the top of my head, but we did send warning notices to a few hundred. Mm-hmm. And I think when it actually came time to withhold, it was, you know, in the, you know, 20 or 30 or so. And sometimes, sometimes we say we're going to withhold, or we actually withhold, and a day or two later, they're compliant.
They're compliant. Yeah, it's funny how that works, huh?
We release our funds as soon as they're there.
Yeah. So, okay, so I know this
So we look at performance. We look at compliance. Yeah. We do a lot with transparency.
Yeah.
So we've got a site, the Transparent Utah, where you can go look and see. It basically opens the check register of any governmental entity in Utah.
Right.
You can see what employees are paid. So we had USA Today contact us, I think it was yesterday, wanting some understanding of what certain government employees are getting paid.
Yeah.
In this case, it was the sports guys. I think they wanted to know what the football coaches at the U were making.
Yeah.
And we have a site. You can just go right there, transparent.utah.gov.
Yep.
You can put in the name of any government employee.
Okay.
So, and we do some IT audits and stuff like that. My office, when it peaks, is about 50 individuals.
Mm-hmm. So when it peaks, and are you suggesting then that there's like a core full-time staff? And then do you bring on, for this season, for example, when you have a lot of business, do you bring on contractors or you bring on extra people to help?
We bring on interns.
Yeah.
So think about
paid
in January, paid interns.
Good. Love the sound of that.
Yeah. They make about $23-$25 bucks an hour paid.
Yeah.
But they come in the January, May timeframe.
Yeah.
And then we're test driving them to see if they're, you know, have what it takes to be an auditor, and they're test driving us to see if they like what we do.
Yeah. So regular listeners to the show, I hope that you're enjoying this kind of deeper dive into what really makes, components of our government function. And I think there's a lot of sense that some of this can be very, it sounds, I think, overly technical, or it can feel, I don't mean to say what you do is boring, but it can sound disinteresting, I think, to the average person. But when I hear what you're talking about, to me, what that is really the critical, and I think I would describe it as sacred bond, that public officials have when it comes to the appropriation of the funds that they collect off of taxpayers. And so it really is an important role, and understanding that at all, not at all, but your county has an elected auditor, obviously the state has an elected auditor, and you can go to transparent.utah.gov, and there you're able to see really how money is being spent in your community. Look at the when you get your tax bill, right? Then it's got your property tax. If you receive a property tax bill, it breaks down the special districts that you're in. Look, you know, obviously I'm in Salt Lake County, and then I can also see what other entities are collecting taxes. I rely on your office to make sure that those entities are compliant and they are using our funds appropriately. Uh-huh. So if people, like, I guess I would say the thing that became so surprising to me in county government was that you really hear from just such a minority of individuals. And I think there's quite a bit of confusion about tax dollars and how tax dollars work. So
which entity is getting them,
right? And when you see taxes going up,
county taxes are so high. Well, it's usually the school district.
Sometimes.
Which is a big proportion of those taxes.
Yeah, yeah. Or really where those dollars are going, I think, is also quite confusing to people. If I'm not mistaken, almost 80 cents on the dollar for, the budget of Salt Lake County goes to public safety. And I think we can, there's broad consensus that we might think about safety in different ways, but I think there's broad consensus that we should have that we believe that people should be able to live in safe communities. But really thinking through how it is that those dollars are spent and where they're spent, those are decisions that are made, often at we have some of that decision making at the state legislature, but a lot of that is made at your county government level. But you're really saying, are these groups compliant? Are these entities compliant with the work that they're saying that they're going to do? Are they spending the dollars they said they were going to do it? Are they transparent in how they're doing it?
And then if there's non-compliance, we have a hotline, hotline.utah.gov. People can report waste, fraud, and abuse concerns. If you hear about a public official stealing money, that's usually my team that investigated.
Yeah.
When you hear about non-compliance, oftentimes that's us reporting on it, my
team. Yeah. So I really do think it's important.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's critical. And I describe it as being a watchdog, a constitutional watchdog working on behalf of the public.
Yeah.
Now, when you get down to the counties, county auditors are slightly different depending on the county you're in.
Yeah.
Most of those are more like chief financial officers. They're the guys that run the finance system more than doing the audit. I describe The old term auditor is chief financial officer, is the term we use today.
Yeah.
The new term is auditor in the sense of what we do in my office.
Right. So, and that's a little different in Salt Lake County, which is a county of the first class.
That's right. Salt Lake County's a little unique.
Bigger. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so the role is a bit different, but also
Salt Lake County is the closest to my office.
Oh yeah.
In terms of comparability.
Right. That sounds right. Okay. So you've really taken us through a deep dive and I appreciate it. And I think we're going to have potentially a little bit more of a philosophical conversation here in the second section as well, but we're also heading into the holidays. And I would just encourage listeners, you know, if you've got questions, we're always looking for creative shows around the holiday time. And if you'd like to send suggestions around topics that you would like John to speak more to, I would be happy to speak to, or certainly we can ask Natalie questions. We would love to hear those from you. So please get in contact with us on social media or send a message to the station. But you are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle, and I'm with John Dougal. I'm Shireen Gorbani. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
I'm Shireen Gorbani on the left.
I'm John Dougal on the right.
And you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle.
The unsupervised edition.
That's right. Natalie is off in the world, busy without us, and so we are here alone today.
And Anthony's off too.
That's right. We're fully unsupervised. We're
completely. So I really want to know, Shireen, a little bit more about yourself, your political leanings and stuff like that. You're on the left side of the aisle.
I sure am.
And I'm going to give you a hypothetical. If you were back in D.C., what are some things that you would tackle? Because I know you have concerns, just like I have concerns.
Yeah, that's right. So, wow. When I think about
it,
it's been a while since I've really thought about what I would do if I were in Congress. But I have to say, when I was running in 2018, you know, talking to people all over the state, the reason I got into politics was around the issue of healthcare. As a reminder to everyone, it is open enrollment. If you or someone you know is looking to get coverage, Take Care Utah is our local organization that can help walk you through all of the options to get healthcare coverage. But I think there's a lot that really needs to be done, that continues to need to be addressed in terms of lowering cost and increasing access to healthcare in this country. So I would be thinking about all of the creative and interesting things that we're seeing in that space. There are a lot of states that are really leading out on this, looking at innovation waivers that they're applying to federal government to try new things, to really expand access, reduce cost, all of those things. And so those are the key areas of work that I would really want to be engaged in. And I feel really lucky and fortunate to be able to spend a lot of my time and thought energy in my work now, you know, thinking about that intersection of policy, healthcare, but then also trying to work to address things like nutrition security in our country. I grew up in North Dakota. I'm really interested in agriculture and farming. I'm interested in food systems. I'm interested in what we can do to improve access to nutritious food across this entire country, because it is such a determinant of health and well-being. And I think a lot about, you know, some of the things that it feels like we have broad consensus on in the general public, but that we just don't see that much movement on in Washington. And a big part of that for me is the role of dark money in politics, and also just kind of our entire financial structure around candidates, and the I think unrelenting effort that people have to make to continue to stay there by dialing for dollars, you know, numerous hours every week regardless of which side of the aisle. And so I would love to see a really robust conversation around reform in that space. I support the idea of public funding for campaigns. I also would love to see that, you know, like if we could think about time shortening, a lot of other places have elections that take place in a much shorter time span than ours do. But I think really reform, transparency.
You mean 4 years is...
Yeah, it's a lot, right?
Ouch.
Or I even think about, I mean, Mike Lee was in the news for fundraising for Herschel Walker, saving half of that money for his own PAC. That makes total sense, right? But I don't like that that's how campaigns work. I don't like how we have campaign finance in this country. And I also think, frankly, it keeps people who have certain access to resources in that game, and plenty of people who have great ideas or expertise out of the game. So I would say campaign finance reform is something that would be top of the line for me, but actually also related to the work that you do, thinking about the ways in which rules are really set up to not protect and benefit people. So consumer protection efforts is something that I'm really passionate about. You know, everything from banking reform to transparency in hospital billing, which we've gotten, you know, a lot of movement on lately. But those are some of the things that I think about that I feel like would have a great impact in people's everyday lives and also change government.
So you and I both care a lot about the cost of healthcare. So let me push back and ask you a clarifying question.
Yeah.
Because my concern is every time the government, especially the federal government, touches healthcare, they seem to make it more costly, more ineffective, more hassles and hoops you got to jump through to try and get healthcare and driving up the cost. I mean, they're going to fix pharmaceuticals and they drive up the cost. They're going to fix all sorts of other things and they drive up the cost. That's my perception.
Yeah.
So tell me
the other side of that.
Because I'm reading into it, you're thinking more government involvement will help with the cost issues. Talk to me about my concern.
So I think there could be a mix of solutions there, right? So we have chosen to build the most expensive system on earth that doesn't really have the health outcomes to suggest that what we're doing is working well, right? But what I can also tell you is that when you talk to people who are on Medicare, largely they like it. You know, they find that they're able to get care and they're able to get quality care in a timely manner. When we think about kind of all the ways that this is complicated, it's hard, I guess. There have to be ways that we could be thinking about increasing access, reducing cost, balancing regulation is a big part of that, right? Are we making sure that we're keeping people safe and protected and transparent, you know, systems where they're not going to, you know, die when they go for care? But are we also doing that in a way that that fosters innovation in a healthcare space? And I do think it's difficult, and it's going to take ideas from all sides of the political spectrum to get it done. But what I know is the way that things were before the ACA were not good. Far too many people were, you know, accumulating huge medical debt and really couldn't get access to care. So increasing access to care is certainly a big component of where my priorities are.
Right. And see, one of my concerns is the federal government largely has tied health, I use the word loosely, insurance, it's really more like prepaid medical, to your employer.
Right.
So when you need it most, you're most at risk of losing it when you get sick and lose your job all of a sudden. Well, and so it's
universal
perverse.
Universal healthcare would save it.
And I used to tell my employees years ago in the private sector, I said, I survey all of you to find out what healthcare plan you want so I can take the average of that and give you the healthcare plan none of you want.
Okay. That's one way to do it.
Which is, I mean, that's just the nature, because you want one thing, you want something else, you want something else. And by the time you combine it together for your employee pool, it's kind of the average of what they want, but not really what anybody wanted.
Yeah.
And then you look and say, you know, rather than, you know, we're used to paying cash when we go in the grocery store, this and that or the other. And and if you're on food stamps, if you will, or SNAP, you get some site assistance, but it doesn't really distort the nature of the market in the grocery store. But when it comes to healthcare, it heavily distorts the market. And when, you know, years ago, I'm a largely cash pay kind of guy. When I went in to do cash pay, they didn't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And thought I was trying to rip them off. I'm like, no, I want to pay my bill before I walk out the door. I don't want to deal with 2, 3, 4 months of haggling back and forth. And what is it? And, you know, so I want the prices. And I look at things like LASIK and go, okay, when the government is minimally involved, all of a sudden quality is going up, cost is going down.
Yeah.
And yet over here, we got the government heavily involved, and it's really ineffective, and it doesn't really meet people's needs. And like you said, it drives up the cost, puts people in horrible debt, other things like that. And when you need it most, which is for catastrophic kind of events, all of a sudden it leaves a lot of folks high and dry.
Yeah. And I would say that when we think about things like primary care, I'm willing to go down this kind of, you know, thought experiment with you, but it becomes a lot more difficult when we're thinking about specialty care or things like everything from cancer care to, you know, rare disease, right? There is no cost model that works for that. So how are we going to do the best that we can to increase access, understanding that I think for me, and really, you know, it is a core value that I think that we should be, you know, participating in a system where we collectively believe that we should invest in infrastructure that allows us to take care of each other. Roads, public safety, healthcare for me is one of those things. Education certainly is another. Yeah. I know that's like a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, but that's one of those dynamics, because I sit there and I, you know, if you will, I hear more, we got to do more with the government, this and that and the other. And I just sit there and part of it's my personal experience. And part of it, I live in the world in which I see government failure every day.
Right.
Now I see good, hardworking government employees, but I see the system failing too often.
Yeah.
And then I scratch my head and go, well, why would I want it doing even more when it just seemed, and I sometimes hear folks, well, we just need to get the right people. We need to do this. We need to do that. Human nature is what human nature is. Systems are what systems are.
Yeah.
And why I generally am a fan of private sector activities is every day when I'm shopping, when I'm doing business, it's a little micro vote to say I'm in favor of this and I'm against that.
Yeah.
And there's market forces that drive companies where I'm regulating and you're regulating and everybody else is regulating these companies in this sense that too often government, we have a high stake election every 2 years or 4 years,
yeah.
and it just doesn't have the same incentives and response to the public demand.
Right.
Or and catering to your needs versus my needs. It's a one size fits all in many cases.
Sure. And I think if the public demand were really the thing that was driving private sector, then I would feel differently. But what we know is often driving the private sector is the bottom line. And so different decisions are made about who gets care and who doesn't, what kinds of communities would have access
and those
that do not.
And I'm not just talking healthcare.
Right.
I'm just, yeah.
Right. But I'm saying, like, if we're thinking about health equity, so making sure that everyone has opportunity, and we know that we do not have an equitable health system now. We know that Black moms, for example, are much more likely to lose their lives giving birth to a child than white moms are, right? Like, we know that we have these structural...
We even have some things so mundane as the little oxygen meter on your finger that if you're Black versus white, all of a sudden it responds differently. And it wasn't really understood at the time they were designing it.
And I don't know that we could just rely on the public sector to really think about in the ways that we need to be thinking about and really addressing critical health inequities. But I do think that there's room for a lot of these ideas when it comes to advancing solutions.
So in our final couple of minutes, let me ask you just a quick thing. Okay, there's federal and then there's local.
Sure.
And I'm also one of those that's trying to push it to the local. If we're going to have government do it, let's have it local and not at the federal level. What are your thoughts?
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
So I'm interested in that. I would say that my experience being in not the most local, but fairly local government is that I hear a lot of Republicans in the state say this, but at the end of the day, they want to have control. So I am really interested in...
Human nature is local control is their control.
That's right. I'm local. Here's what I think. I do think some of the best solutions are made closest to the people and in collaboration with those who are most impacted by the decisions, right? And far too often, people with lived experience are not at the table when these decisions are being made. And we ignore too often, I think, what people really live day to day that drives behavior, political ideology, all of those things. And I will say something I'm really proud of at this program is that I think that we try to model that you still can have conversations with people that you deeply disagree with. And what I hope people take from this is that I am informed deeply by the conversations I have with you, certainly by Natalie's expertise and just expansive knowledge. But when we do not when we can't see people's value, we often, I think they get kind of washed out in policy making and decision making. So I would love to see decisions made as close to people as possible, but I would also like to see more people in those seats that are committed public servants, that are from a diversity of backgrounds, that can give voice to what's happening in their worlds.
Well, this is one of the things that's broken in politics. You and I may have an issue we disagree with.
Yeah.
And I don't say Shireen's evil. She's bad and whatever.
Yeah.
I come from the perspective of, okay, I have a certain perspective and I need to work harder to help her better understand that perspective as she works harder to help me understand, your perspective.
So nice of you to ignore my horns and forked tongue.
No, but it's one of those things in politics. I hear all these people, well, they're evil, evil, evil. Usually my experience is most people are well-intended.
Yeah.
Whether or not what they think will work actually works is a whole different matter.
Totally.
There's lots of good intentions, but you need to be able to engage and say, okay, where's the common ground that you and I, for example, we both agree on how do we deal with the cost of healthcare?
Yeah.
Now let's, from that common ground, find ways that we disagree and where we disagree and how to navigate that.
Yeah.
And just accept that is life.
Totally.
We have different life experiences, different focuses. We see the world differently based on our experiences.
Yeah.
And how we're trying to fix problems and what we think. Because, Yogi Berra said, predictions are hard, especially about the future. And that's when we're dealing with public policy. We're looking to say, okay, we should do X because I think in the future it will do Y.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this sort of unusual conversation.
The unsupervised.
Unsupervised, not getting too much into the news.
We'll see what feedback we get.
There's lots of important and interesting things happening on the political landscape, and I'm sure we'll get back to them next week. But you've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Shireen Gourbani, joined by
John Dougal.
We've been fully unsupervised, but the normal producer of this program is Anthony Scoma, and we thank you so much for listening.